I'd give for that wonderful phrase, to hear those three little words. That's all I'd live for.
Joining us now is Patricia T. O'Connor, the author of a number of books on the English language. I'll go through the list later. Hi, Pat.
Hi, how are you?
It's always a pleasure to see you, and you know our audience just loves these segments, so I want to get right down to it. You saw that article in the New York Times about how the justices of the Supreme Court are going to the dictionary to define simple words like of?
Yes, isn't that interesting? This article was inspired by a new study done by a couple of legal scholars. One is a professor at CUNY, who found that in the last 10 years or so, 225 Supreme Court opinions cited dictionary definitions for almost 300 words and phrases. And the justices used more than 120 different dictionaries for definitions of these words, and it was words like prevent, license, report, delay, and even, as you say, little words like of, if, now, also. And this is really unusual.
Well, that's suggesting that the dictionaries are part of legal precedent.
Yes, and also part of the problem with this is that Well, both legal scholars and lexicographers agree that it's really not a good idea, because first of all, you have a choice among dictionaries, and they've used 120 different ones.
I guess they pick and choose to find the one that satisfies their predilection as it is.
You can go in and you can find it's like reading different translations of the Bible. You can see almost anything in them that you want. And I'm not saying that the justices are going after certain things, but if they did have a certain, even maybe subconscious prejudice or bias towards one argument or another, they would certainly be able to justify that by dictionary definition.
Now, how long has this been going on?
Well, the study was of the last 10 years.
So it's mostly this current court with a few changes.
Right, although the article did say that for the previous 10 years it had been almost that much, but before, for instance, in the whole decade of the 60s, there were only 23 such citations. So this is really quite unusual.
Well, I have to tell you that it occurred to me one day that the cheapest introduction to a segment on the show is like the last one. I could have said, the word seduction is defined in my American Heritage Dictionary as blah, 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 blah.
Right.
In France, you would get a different definition.
Right.
I don't do that anymore. It's just too easy.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I think that if they're basing judicial decisions on the definition or mm-hmm. using it to justify, mm-hmm. that's a cheap way of going about serious business.
Yeah, I mean, it's really not a good idea to rely on dictionary definitions to decide what Congress meant when it created federal legislation. I mean, there are three big arguments. First, dictionaries don't agree, so you can stack the deck if you want. Two, dictionaries were not meant to be prescriptive, at least not in modern times. They're meant to be descriptive of how the language is used at a certain time. And three,
and the founding fathers used different dictionaries,
or
they didn't even have dictionaries.
They had Samuel Johnson's dictionary, I suppose, and there were other ones. That was pre-Webster. But the point is that language isn't mathematics, and lexicographers are human beings. Even the most objective of lexicographers can't help having certain prejudices and biases that might creep into the order in which they list the senses of a word or the phraseology in which they describe it and whatnot. And someone said in the 19th century that the lexicographer is a historian, not a lawgiver. So there are a lot of problems about this.
And we've talked about this in terms of the language itself. We don't have the equivalent of the French Academy in this country
mm-hmm.
because we recognize that language has fluidity.
Oh, sure. What a dictionary is for, I mean, for ordinary people like you and me, it's for us to have some source to go to find out what the great weight of reasonable, educated opinion is about what a word means right now, how it should be used right now. If you go to the 56 printing of the Oxford Second International Unabridged, you'll find different meanings that you'll find today. And, well, another example is, you're too young to remember this, but and so am I, but in the early part of the 20th century, Funk and Wagnalls was the bee's knees. It was the premier American dictionary to go to. And it was, it had close to a 500,000 entries. It was thorough. It was this, it was that. It was wonderful. Then along came Webster's Second International in the 30s. And it was the bee's knees. And the problem was Funk and Wagnalls never updated itself. It didn't revise itself, and it fell by the wayside. All modern dictionaries now revise and update themselves. And in fact, just this morning, the OED released its latest round of revisions. This is the online Oxford English Dictionary, 1,840 revisions to existing entries.
And we use the American Heritage Dictionary on the show just because that's what we have in our bookcase. But it was created because somebody felt that there was need for another dictionary and another approach.
Sure. And as a matter of fact, this dictionary is being updated. We have the fourth edition here. The fifth edition is coming out in November. And the other major American dictionary that I use a lot is the Merriam-Webster's Collegiate, and I think it's also preparing an updated edition. So that's what these publishers do. They try to stay on top of the language. And that's why dictionary definitions aren't appropriate in the courtroom.
My guest is Patricia T. O'Connor. Her books, Woe Is I, and later Woe Is I, Jr., Words Fail Me, You Send Me, Origins of the Specious, different looks at the English language. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate, and we invite your calls at 646-829-3985. That's 646-829-3985, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. And we're also interested in not just your questions about the language, something we do whenever Pat is here, but how you use the dictionary and whether things have changed now that you can look up words on the internet. I still keep a dictionary and a thesaurus nearby when I'm working because I actually find it easier and more convenient to go through the book than to have to go to the internet and go through all of that rigmarole. But some people will not even bother opening a book anymore. I don't know how you feel about that, Pat.
Well, I too have hard copies of the two standard American dictionaries I mentioned, and I have the OED online. But it's also nice to be able to go on the internet and see what, say, the Longman British Dictionary says or the Macmillan British Dictionary. You can't possibly have on your desk, unless you have a huge desk, all the dictionaries you might want to consult.
Well, of course, this leads a listener, Cole from Atlanta, to ask you which dictionary is the best on the market or which is the best for most people's use.
I can't say definitively one way or the other. There are sort of two answers to that. It kind of depends on what you're using your dictionary for. The American Heritage is handy because it has great usage notes. I think the type is bigger. It's a little bit more conservative than Merriam-Webster. On the other hand, Merriam-Webster is handy because it's the dictionary that a lot of publishing companies use, and it's likely to have a little more liberal view of, say, accepting newer pronunciations, newer senses of words. They're a little bit ahead of they're on the front part of the curve on that sort of thing. So I like to use both.
Now, a listener disagrees with what you've been saying. Tyler asks, The entire law in this country is based solely on language. Both statutes and precedent legal opinions are written in language. What are lawyers and judges supposed to base arguments upon, if not dictionaries?
Well, that's a good question. A lot of statutes are either self-explanatory or can be understood through common sense. And I think it was Judge Learned Hand that said that lawyers should not hide behind the fortress of a dictionary in interpreting the law, that you should have a sympathetic understanding and a common sense feeling for what was intended. In other words, you should trust your own judgment, make your own arguments, because although laws stay the same unless they're altered and the language stays the same, understanding of that language has subtle shifts over time, and dictionaries can't keep up with, you know, you'd have to go back to the dictionaries that were current, say, in 1956, if a law was written in 1956.
And then there's a lot of ambiguity in laws.
You'd have many dictionaries to choose from, and you'd have many senses of the different words to choose from.
And many of the cases that go to the Supreme Court are based on the fact that different people are reading the same law to mean different things.
Yes, and a dictionary isn't going to help you to sort those things out.
Should we take some calls?
Yeah.
Again, our number 646-829-3985. And Corey from New York, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm an attorney, and I specialize in constitutional law. And one of the things that you're missing is that the prevailing theories of constitutional interpretation that are most relied on by a majority now are originalism and literalism. And originalism means take a look at what the writers of the Constitution or statute meant by the use of the words in their time. Mm-hmm. So you can't just go pick a dictionary at random to try to figure out what they meant at the time. You take a look at those dictionaries, for example, and those examples of word usage in their time, in order to figure out what they meant.
So, Corey, now, are they citing Samuel Johnson's dictionary? Because Noah Webster didn't write his dictionary until
1828.
Yeah, the beginning of the 19th century, long after the Constitution was written.
Exactly. They will cite whatever dictionaries were available or whatever sources. They'll use examples of how words were used at that time.
Well, and so is that the case?
If you're going to try to find the original intent, either, for example, at the time that the original Constitution was written, or, for example, in the post-Civil War period when the great Civil War amendments, the 13th, 14th, and 15th, that completely changed the Constitution, were written, you have to, under this theory, you must try to understand the words as the writers understood them. So that's why you go to contemporary sources and dictionaries to do that. Now, the learned hand approach is a disfavored approach now in constitutional and statutory interpretation because of the fact that Scalia and those people are ascendant in the court, and they are originalists and literalists.
I have to go to a break, Corey, but I do want to ask you this question again. Are Scalia and Thomas et al. Going back to Samuel Johnson's dictionary, or are they going to Merriam-Webster, to whatever dictionary they happen to have at hand to find these word definitions? I suspect none of them are going to Samuel Johnson's dictionary.
They are.
Well, Samuel Johnson, a London British, you know, a British dictionary writer.
They're going back to word usage at the time. Now, certainly for the important post-Civil War amendments, they're going to the sources that were available in the post-Civil War period. But the purpose of looking at the dictionary is not to look at a contemporary dictionary, unless you're talking about a recent statute. If you're looking at a recent statute, then they simply go to recent dictionaries, and there was one decision that came down this week that was looking at word usage. But again, it's not to try to pick the dictionary, and they argue about an awful lot, but they don't argue about the dictionaries that they're choosing. The purpose is to simply find out what the people who wrote these statutes were depending on for the word meaning. Now, that doesn't mean that you just blindly follow the dictionary. I mean, you have to look at the word in the context of the statute. But if there's a question as to what a word means, and if it's a key word, they've got no place else to go but the dictionary. They can't just say, well, you know, we think it probably meant this, because that's completely unmoored from any principle other than the judge's whim.
Corey, your point is well taken. And we thank you very much for calling us. We have to go to a break right now. Again, the number is 646-829-3985. We'll come back and we'll talk about other things as well. A lot of people have questions about standard usage, whether you should say I or me and things like that. My guest is Patricia T. O'Connor, who also has a blog called Grammophobia.com. You might want to check that out. We'll be back right after this.
Oh, baby, what I'd give to hear those three little words. Man, that's such a wonderful.
And those three little words are Patricia T. O'Connor. And we are taking your calls at 646-829-3985. People have been writing in, and we have questions like, where is that one that the first person? Oh, gee, I just have too many here. Just wait one second. Okay, there it is. A person wants to know, Debbie in Brooklyn, is this correct? My sisters and my dog. It sounds awkward, she says.
My sisters and my dog?
Yeah.
yeah, if you're talking, that's a multiple. That's called a compound subject, unless it's an object.
Well, how do you say the
dog
that?
I ran over my sisters and my dog. That's a compound object. If you
said
my sisters and my dog,
the dog that my
me.
Sister and I own. How do you say that? That's what she's trying to say.
Oh,
there.
The dog that my sister and I owned.
Yes.
Yes, I owned. My sister and I owned these dogs.
Yeah.
It's I.
No, the dog. Yeah, but sometimes you don't want to say that we own them. Our dog. My sisters and my dog.
But we don't really own them, the pet that people say we are. But yeah, the proper pronoun is I, if that's the question.
Another person asks, some of these questions confound me. Bob in Manhattan, why has, for instance, completely replaced, for example? Has it?
Not that I know of. In fact, I find myself in my writing using for example so much that I throw in a for instance every once in a while for variety. But I'm not noticing more of for instance than of for example.
John from Astoria called to comment on last month's show about ad-libbing in the movies. Mm-hmm. It was mentioned that in the movie Dog Day Afternoon, when Al Pacino said Attica, it was not a scripted line. Pacino said in an interview that the assistant director told him to say it.
Well, that wouldn't be an ad-lib then.
Yeah.
He was still told to say it. So I wouldn't call it an ad-lib. Everything unscripted isn't an ad-lib.
Let's take another call. This is from Paul from Harlem. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello. I'm calling to talk about the word disingenuous, which is my least favorite word.
Why is it your least favorite word?
Because it hides the word lie. And when people lie, especially public officials, instead of a reporter writing that they lied, it comes out they were disingenuous. And it seems that this is a very soft excuse for lying.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like people do it more and more.
But wait a minute. There is subtlety here.
Right.
Disingenuous kind of suggests that you're avoiding or you're being crafty about a response. Mendacious means that you're being totally lying. So there's a
right.
range here. Disingenuous suggests...
You can be disingenuous
I guess
without
point,
lying. You can just leave something out. You can omit something important and be disingenuous.
My point is that the word lie or lying is avoided, and these other mm-hmm. words are used to soften the blow, you know?
Right. People tend to get all upset if you say they lied.
When when Bloomberg was in Washington a couple of years ago testifying about school test scores and he lied about them, the New York Times said that he misrepresented test scores.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's this avoidance of truth in stating that people are lying.
I can understand that, though. If someone says something non-factual, when you say he lied, you're presuming that he did it on purpose. If you say he misrepresented or was disingenuous, it might meant that he didn't know, that he was unknowing or misinformed.
Well, it's left to us to interpret. I know the word misspoke is another one like
right.
that. Now, I have misspoken. Accidentally, I've used this word instead mm-hmm. of that word just before I said that Jennifer Grant was going to talk about her daughter when I meant to say her father.
Mm-hmm.
There are other times when we misspeak, as you say, because we don't know the real answer.
Mm-hmm.
And then sometimes when I read that somebody claimed he misspoke, a politician, he lied and he got caught.
And the thing is, when you say you misspoke, your listeners know what you mean. They know that what you're thinking is he lied, but Leonard can't say he lied.
Yeah.
I mean, we all know the games that are being played. But I agree with the caller that it would be refreshing once in a while to hear someone really called a liar who lies. But a newspaper isn't going to do it.
Judy from the Bronx, how you're on the air?
Hi, I'm a retired librarian, although I don't think a librarian ever actually retires. And I cherish each of my five unabridged dictionaries, the 1840 edition and mm-hmm. the four 1940 editions. I consult them regularly when I'm reading the New York Times and sometimes when I'm reading a hardcover volume. And I'd like to know what you think of we who hoard our unabridged dictionaries.
Oh, I hoard mine, too. I have an old Webster's Second International that I believe we have it because my brother-in-law rescued it from a dumpster. But it's I love it. It's I don't know what we'd do without it because you can't go on the internet and find, you know, the 1909 for original Webster's Unabridged, as far as I know. You can go online and find some old dictionaries. But
doesn't the OED provide you with the historical record over the years?
Sure, it does. And it'll tell you when a certain sense developed and all that. But sometimes it's nice to just be able to go to an old Webster's and say, oh, look, the word spelled N-I-C-H-E used to have only one pronunciation, niche. You wouldn't know that unless you were able to look it up.
You mean the way I pronounce it because I'm so old.
Niche. And it probably
has schism.
Schism. Yes, so all those, the old pronunciations are preserved in there. And they're a lot of fun. So I agree with you. I just wish I had more room for hoarding those big old dictionaries. Also, it's getting harder and harder to lift them. They weigh about 10 or 15 pounds each. It doesn't sound like much, but...
And now with an iPhone, they weigh practically nothing.
Yeah.
Daniel left this comment on our show page. He said, I'm currently writing my doctoral thesis, and I find myself forced to write we instead of I, though I most often really mean I.
Mm.
Where did the convention in academic work come from?
What's it called? The royal we?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure where that came from. I have a feeling that I once did a blog item on that years ago, but I can't remember right now. But the convention is that when you're writing certain kinds of things, you don't refer to yourself as I, you say we. I didn't know that people were still doing that. But monarchs usually do that kind of thing, I guess because they're just bigger than a single individual.
We have Tony from Manhattan calling. Oh, Toby from Manhattan. Hi, Toby.
Hi. I just wanted to say that when I heard about the topic that you were going to discuss initially about dictionary definitions, it reminded me a number of years ago, I remember hearing that just after 9/11, when the Bush administration was all in a panic and they were deciding how to deal with enemy combatants or non-combatants or whatever the hell they called them, the Cheney and his merry men, went to dictionaries to get the most, quote-unquote, liberal definition of torture, and what they came up with was organ failure or death.
Well, you know, that's, as we were saying before, you can find almost anything you want in
some
dictionary.
Don't tell Antonin Scalia which dictionary that's in. Doris in Manhattan says, one benefit to the online dictionaries is the audio pronunciation icon, although I don't always agree with the received pronunciation.
Yes, and I can't always get my computer to play it. But it is fascinating. And if you go to the Macmillan online dictionary, you can switch back and forth between the American and the British pronunciations, which is interesting. But it's true, you won't always agree with the pronunciations, and by that I mean it may not be your pronunciation. But then it's a big country.
Our next caller is Emily from New Jersey. Hi, Emily. Emily, are you
Hello,
there?
Hello there.
Yes.
I'm not from actually New Jersey. I'm in Scottsdale, Arizona.
Oh, Arizona. Oh, gee.
Yes. No problem. But I was just calling to say a little different perspective. Not that I'm not well aware of the power and the beauty of written dictionaries and having them physically with you. I just graduated college. And my friends and I often, in public settings, a lot of us are working for law firms and starting our careers and things, we'll actually get out our smartphones in a social setting and look up the definition of a word on different websites that we have tabbed on our little smartphones and, you know, and use them in arguments to, you know.
This has become one of the most annoying things in life. People had discussed, who was that person who said this thing? And somebody pulls out the smartphone. The next thing you know, they've Googled it. And
right.
Conversation is killed.
No room for argument anymore.
Swords, with these new technologies is that, you know, back in the day, our parents used to say things to us, and we'd totally take it for golden and not ever question what they were saying. But
now you can argue with
social
them.
Settings, right. You can actually look it up and say, actually, that's not true.
I love it.
And hold people to their words. So, yeah,
I just
wanted to say that. And I also agree with the gentleman that was just speaking, or you just mentioned the person that wrote to you about the audio pronunciation. I found those very helpful, too, especially with friends of mine that have been foreign exchange students and they were using English as their second language. Sometimes yes is not correct 100% in terms of linguistically, but I found that helpful as well.
Now, just one thing, Emily, before you go. How did you live in New York before you went to Scottsdale, or did you discover us there?
My family lives in New York. My aunt works for KPMG. I travel there regularly, but I personally don't live in New York. I prefer your show to the Arizona show, so I listen to that. I'm at work right now at a law firm, and so I tune into you almost every day.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah.
Not a problem.
David in West Hempstead says people use words other than lie to avoid libel charges and such.
Yes. I mean, there's a difference between calling someone a liar and calling him disingenuous in public. I don't think you'd get sued for calling someone disingenuous, but you could get sued for calling someone a liar. So there are ramifications to your choice of words.
Sam in Manhattan brings up something we've discussed in the past. How do you feel about the abandonment of number agreement, that is, replacing his or her with their for simplicity's sake?
Well, I don't think it's been abandoned, but that's a very complex subject because the whole all those third-person plurals, they, them, and their, used to be used as singulars before about the mid 1700s, and nobody thought anything of it. They were used for universal purposes, non-number and gender neutral.
And you used to be only plural, and now it's both singular and plural.
Yeah, and so that's another example of how language changes.
If you want to ask Pat a question, because we've run out of time, you can always email her directly at mailbox@grammophobia.com, and you can click on Pat's blog at grammophobia.com to see a selection of language questions from WNYC listeners. She will be back with us on July 20th, and I suspect that we'll go through more of the same kind of being overwhelmed by calls that we were today.
I hope so.